remember what they'd learned. Then the scientists inhibited melatonin activity in the fish. They did this by blocking melatonin receptors with inhibitory drugs. The fish's melatonin levels were unchanged, but the ability of melatonin to affect the brain was blocked. With melatonin activity blocked, the ability of the fish to form new memories was drastically improved, even at night. This research has potential benefits for humans. For example, the use of melatonin receptor blockers could improve performance of nighttime cognitive tasks, helping people such as night shift workers or students cramming for exams. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger, with help from Jeffrey Alberts in Psychological and Brain Sciences. I'm Yael Cassander.
Let's turn our attention now to sports. Robert Carlson and Jeev Singh are the clubhouse leaders in the first round of the PGA Championship at Oakland Hills. The two opened with two under par 68s, leaving them one shot ahead of Sergio Garcia and Ken Duke. Sean O'Hare and Charlie Wee were on the course at minus two. Morgan Hamm has given up his spot on the U.S. men's gymnastics team after aggravating a left ankle injury during training in Beijing. He clearly struggled on floor exercise during the men's training session yesterday, and it wasn't any better today. Hamm's withdrawal leaves the team without anyone with previous Olympic experience. The New York Jets will introduce Brett Favre at a news conference today in Cleveland, less than 24 hours after acquiring him from Green Bay for a conditional 2009 draft pick. General manager Mike Tannenbaum said there would be another transaction regarding quarterback Chad Pennington, who spent his first eight seasons with the Jets. The regular season begins a month from today, and the Chicago Bears will get warmed up tonight when they play their first preseason game, a matchup with the Kansas City Chiefs at Soldier Field. Coach Lovie Smith says he's anxious to see how some of the less experienced players will do in the game. Ace Kyle Loesch is on the mound this afternoon as St. Louis is playing the Los Angeles Dodgers. The Cards are trying for a sweep of their three-game set with Los Angeles. In the bottom of the fifth, however, LA leads St. Louis 4-0. And the AL Central leading Chicago White Sox will go for another series sweep of the struggling Detroit Tigers at U.S. Cellular Field tonight. Chicago is 9-5 against Detroit this season and swept a three-game set at Comerica Park in April. Since the start of the 2005 season, the Sox have logged a 46-24 mark against the Tigers. That's sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designers of the M2 on Neal mixed-use project in downtown Champaign. On the web at ratioarchitects.com.
Coming up today on The World from PRI, the Beijing Olympics logo is copyrighted and protected by Chinese authorities. But China remains the land of counterfeit knockoffs. Phony Olympic gear was all over Beijing streets until recent days. On the trail of pirated Olympic swag, that and the day's news coming up today on The World. The program begins at 3 this afternoon. If you're really trying to save on gas, you might like to know that there's a new way to hitchhike. Rebecca Williams reports on a new online carpooling network.
It's called Zimride. What you do is log on, create an account, and then type in where you want to go. Then you can catch a ride with other people headed across town or across the country. It's not the first online carpooling network. You can catch rides on Craigslist and other sites. But co-founder John Zimmer says what's missing from those other sites is trust. He says Zimride is safer because it's linked up with Facebook.
So that before you get in the car, you can see what you have in common with the person. You can see a picture of the person. Really what we want to do is build a community so that people can feel more comfortable sharing rides.
But like online dating, you never know exactly what you're going to get. John Zimmer says that's why they built in a feedback function. So if you have a really awkward road trip with someone, you can warn other people away. For The Environment Report, I'm Rebecca Williams.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about The Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org. MichiganRadio.org.
In California, there's political gridlock over the state's massive budget. It's now a month late, and the state is facing a shortfall of some $15 billion. That's led to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger telling thousands of state workers that their paychecks will be cut, and he's now thinking of the once unthinkable, a tax increase. John Myers of member station KQED reports.
Arnold Schwarzenegger has always said he opposed new taxes, but in August 2006, seeking a second term as governor, Schwarzenegger's penchant for hype may have gotten the best of him.
I've said it before and I will say it again. I will not raise taxes on the people of California, period.
You can probably guess what comes next. Now, facing the largest deficit of his tenure and having already used massive borrowing in years past, Governor Schwarzenegger is signaling a willingness to raise taxes. In a private meeting with legislators last weekend, Schwarzenegger suggested a temporary 1% increase in the state sales tax in exchange for reforms to the annual state budget process. That would add about $5.5 billion a year to government revenues. On Wednesday, Schwarzenegger tried to depict the proposal as nothing more than brainstorming.
We have all kinds of different discussions, and I just tried to move the process forward and try to bring both of the parties together and have a responsible budget.
The legislature's majority Democrats think Schwarzenegger is finally coming around to what they've been saying all year. Democrat Don Parada is the president pro tem of the California State Senate.
The fact that the governor now has said we cannot balance this budget, we cannot get through the next 3 or 4 years without at least a temporary tax, I think is a step in the right direction.
But California is one of only 3 states where a supermajority vote in the legislature is needed on the budget. And the sales tax idea has landed with a resounding thud among the governor's fellow Republicans, some of whom have to get on board with any new budget.
This is no time to raise taxes, given the economic situation that this state finds itself in.
State Senate Minority Leader Dave Cogdill says his colleagues prefer more spending cuts beyond the $7 to $8 billion in cuts to education and social services already on the bargaining table. The budget stalemate has also placed the charismatic governor on the wrong side of state workers. With fears California could run out of cash if the impasse lasts much longer, Schwarzenegger has laid off 10,000 temporary workers and has ordered the paychecks of almost 200,000 permanent workers be cut back to minimum wage.
We can't survive on $6.55. We can't survive on $6.55.
That's leading to protests and legal action by the union representing state employees, like this protest at the Department of Motor Vehicles offices in Oakland. Michelle Freeman is a DMV worker whose hours have already been scaled back.
It's not even like this is a discussion. This is our lives. This is somebody in your pocket taking money out of your pocket, taking food out of your mouth, and the roof over your head. It's serious.
Schwarzenegger acknowledged that pain at a news conference last week and apologized to state employees. But the pay cut may never happen. The state's controller has vowed to not reduce the paychecks of workers. Aides to Schwarzenegger say he may ask the courts to intervene. Meantime, millions of dollars owed to vendors doing business with the state can't be sent out. And next week, California is likely to begin the expensive process of borrowing money at high interest rates from Wall Street. For NPR News, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
It's 2:48. Springfield, Illinois' race riot of 1908 started after two black men were sent to the county jail on allegations of crimes against whites. A mob formed, seeking vigilante justice against the men, and chaos spread like wildfire. The then-governor of Illinois called in National Guard troops to quell the destruction, but not before two black men were lynched, black-owned businesses were burned to the ground, and several whites were killed in the crossfire. Years later, scholars in the capital city have pieced together firsthand accounts of the riot. Illinois Public Radio's Jenna Dooley has a report on the man who spearheaded that effort.
Well, I have to confess that I was part of a trend of among younger historians in this country who felt strongly that too much history had been about powerful white males. And so in the 1970s, coming to a university like Sangamon State, I had the opportunity to push the limits a little bit and experiment with teaching new subjects such as African-American history, women's history, the history of violence. All of these were fashionable subjects in the turbulent 1960s and 1970s, and they found a very comfortable place here at a brand new innovative university. So it all started innocently, and then I discovered, to my amazement as a professional historian, that there had been a race riot here in 1908, which is described in some of the good history books, but it seemed an unknown event in Springfield's own self-conscious history. And that really puzzled and, in fact, disturbed me. So in a number of initiatives, I and other people on campus and in the community tried to begin telling the story, promoting the study of the story, and publicizing it.
Was there a common sentiment, a common theme, common frustrations that came out of the bulk of the interviews that was just undeniable that you knew you had to go with?
Well, one of them was the obvious surprise among citizens, particularly white citizens, that they'd been living in this city for 20, 30, 40 years, and they knew nothing about this event, which by any reasonable historical measure was the most significant event in Springfield's history. Not the most significant personality, that's a guy named Lincoln, but the most significant community event. It was an ugly event, but it was significant. And they were puzzled, and I was deeply puzzled, that it had been, in effect, repressed, consciously or subconsciously, for some 60 years. One of the other really interesting themes that came to me as I either interviewed people or, more commonly, gave talks about the race riot, illustrated lectures about the race riot all over town, was the number of white people who came up to me later and said they were amazed to hear this, and they now remembered that an uncle or their parents or a grandparent had taken pity on black refugees the weekend of the rioting and offered them sanctuary in their homes. Now, this is a lovely story, and I was heartened by it, but I was offered that gratuitously. That is to say, I didn't ask for the information. They just came up to me afterwards and told me. I began to think there was an interesting social psychological element in all that, which is a form of explaining how a white family could, in all conscience, talk about a race riot that had come to their community without claiming, and perhaps properly, that their family had been an exception to the rule.
So there was a large sense of now I know, and then a denial still?
I guess you'd call it denial, or at least an effort to rationalize their ancestors' presence in the community during the riot, when it's known by eyewitnesses that thousands of people, either directly or as spectators, took part in the rioting. And so I didn't want to challenge those people to say, I think you're lying. But I found it to be a fascinating characteristic of how a community deals with tragedy in its past.
You might be, you know, in a position to best perhaps analyze where we are now. And I was wondering if you feel that is, you know, because now you said people are asking you for your opinion, and, you know, you haven't been directly, you know, researching things for several years now, but almost more than people who just, you know it from a passing history. Where are we now in 2008?
Springfield is an immensely better city today in race relations than it was in 1908. But it is far, very far from being a really good city. I don't care what the civic authorities say, there is no doubt in my mind that there is strong racism within the police and fire departments of our city and among the administration of our city. It's a more subtle form of racism, but it's racism. So we have made progress. Maybe the lesson of the race riot has taken some sort of hold, but this city is no paragon of race relations virtue by any means.
Is there any fear that the 100 years seems like a logical peak? Okay, we acknowledge it. And then now we can forget?
I think that'll happen. I mean, that's the cynic in me, but there are not going to be events next year anywhere close to the commemorative events this year. It takes a centennial to achieve that. And so there's no doubt in my mind that the race riot will move off of the radar screen next year. But I'd like to think that the markers properly repositioned and whatever publications also surface and or documentaries will keep this a more visible part of our community past than it has been.
Jenna Dooley interviewed Cullum Davis, a retired history professor at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Tomorrow, hear about where Springfield stands today in terms of race relations. And to hear complete coverage from the anniversary of the 1908 race riot, tune into Illinois Edition Friday night, tomorrow night at 10, and Saturday morning at 11. Here on AM 580, on FM 90.9 HD2, or online at will.illinois.edu.
Earth and sky.
Well, I think these exponentially growing technologies are going to transform everything we do.
That's Ray Kurzweil, best known for his projections into the future. They're based on what he calls the law of accelerating returns. That's the idea that once the base of technology has been developed, it grows exponentially every year. He spoke of this century's challenges.
We're going to clean up the environment and replace fossil fuels with renewable forms of energy. That's an exciting prospect. So all of these phenomena or trends will reach tipping points fairly soon and will be quite transformative within 20 years.
Also, how we spend our time.
We're going to be spending more and more of our time in virtual reality environments. We're ultimately going to be able to inhabit these full immersion, very realistic visual, auditory, virtual reality environments, including tactile communication. And that's going to merge with this phenomena of virtual worlds like Second Life, but they're going to become very realistic.
And even life expectancy.
According to my models, within 15 years, we'll be adding more than a year every year to your remaining life expectancy. So as you go forward, your life expectancy will actually move away from you. The sands of time will run in rather than run out.
I spoke with Kurzweil at the 2008 meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I'm Lindsay Patterson for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.